Welcome to the nationally syndicated In the Oil Patch radio show with Kim Bilotto, broadcasting from the Port of Corpus Christi studios. Get more on the Port of Corpus Christi at portofcc.com. In the Oil Patch radio show will give you an inside look at the oil, gas, and energy industry and how it affects you from industry experts and government officials right here on the In the Oil Patch radio show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to In the Oil Patch radio show, where we bring you the movers and shakers in the energy sector. Today, my co-host, Robert Rapier, who is the editor-in-chief of Shell Magazine and is also a senior contributor with Forbes, and I are thrilled to introduce a distinguished guest, a visionary leader in the world of business and a best-selling author. His name is Adam Coffey. Now, Adam's journey is one of remarkable achievements and dedication. As a former U.S. Army sergeant and a GE executive, Adam has led three national private equity-backed service companies, driving transformational growth and fostering high-performance cultures. His expertise spans from being an engineer to an accomplished pilot, reflecting a multifaceted career built on discipline and strategic planning. As an author, Adam has shared his wealth of experience in his trilogy of number one Amazon best-selling books. His first book, Private Equity Playbook, was published in 2019, provides an insider's perspective on working with private equity. This was followed by his Exit Strategy Playbook in 2021, offering invaluable guidance on selling your business, and his latest masterpiece, Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion, released in 2023, equips entrepreneurs with strategies to scale their business to new heights. Join us as we delve into the insights of a man who has not only built empires, but has also empowered others to dream big and achieve even bigger. Adam, welcome to In the Oil Patch Radio Show.
Well, hi there. Thank you for having me. Hello to all your listeners out there.
We are so excited to have you, as I have to admit, I've read every one of your books.
Bless you.
Yes, very excited. Well, you know, I thought oil and gas was complicated, but it seems that private equity is even more complicated as you go down different rabbit holes. And so I'm very excited to have you on the show. But let's begin with tell me and Robert a little bit about your days in GE, because that is a very interesting story of how you really honed in on your expertise.
Again, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. When I look back, I tell people I worked at GE during what I called the Camelot era. You know, at this stage in history, so I was there for 10 years. It was Jack's last 10 years, 1991 to 2001. Matter of fact, he and I left within months of each other. And I would tell you that, you know, when I think back, tech doesn't exist yet the way we know it today. So GE is number one on the Fortune 500 list. It's the world's largest company. It's the world's most admired company. Jack is the world's most admired CEO. And the world's largest company is growing so fast. How fast is it? It's growing so fast. It's doubling in size every 2.8 years. Literally, stock splits three times in the 10 years that I'm there. You know, as a young guy, I just thought money and stock options just would rain from the sky for the rest of my career. You know, it was a magical time to be at GE. It was a magical time to learn, for me, how to run a business. And so I credit Jack and GE with teaching me about running a big business and also about, you know, how to think about growth and think about what's the right, you know, level of growth that we should be shooting for, you know, as business owners or as executives, and really magical time. You know, so all of my experiences in my life, just from a career perspective, were all additive. You know, in the military, I learned about discipline, teamwork, leadership. Engineering made me a meticulous planner. Pilots don't take off unless we know where we're going. And then we deconstruct the trip. And if you're working with private equity, building companies and selling it, you start with an end in mind and you deconstruct the trip. And then Jack informed my thinking about growth and how to build a big business. And so all of this stuff, you know, just me as a sponge, you know, over the last 35 years, soaking all this in, these were the informative experiences that kind of shaped my career.
Wonderful. Well, Robert, jump in here, please. We've experienced, or the energy industry has experienced, a lot of pushback from funding projects. A lot of it is in the name of climate change. And we have, it's not new, but a lot of people have heard of ESG, which is the social, environmental social governance factor now that's also creating issues in the way of being able to fund these large projects. So I guess my first question, since we're a show on energy, how do you see private equity engaging, if you will, in the oil and gas sector? And how will they use, or will they continue to use, private equity for the future, since it seems that Wall Street seems to have issues with funding some of the projects? Is PE a solution potentially?
So let's just think about that and break it down for just a minute. If I think about ESG and I think about private equity, using those two in a sentence, let's think about where private equity gets the majority of its capital from, because I think that informs the thinking, you know, that a lot of them espouse on TV and social media and advertising. So most private equity firms and funds get a large portion of their money from university endowments and from public pension funds. And, you know, with those two limited partner kind of sources of capital being a big chunk of private equity, it should be no surprise to anybody that private equity has adopted, call it an ESG sensitivity, you know, around investing, and almost to the point where in some cases you might think of them as being somewhat activist. You know, and I personally would say that, you know, I'm just, you know, not to get political, but I think that the United States killing its own energy industry has just been absolutely horrific to experience, you know, for firsthand. You know, we've gone from an energy independent country to, you know, to try, I think, trying, you know, to be, you know, to, with good intentions, you know, things often start, may go off the tracks, you know, at some level. So think about electrifying, you know, just today, you know, there was an announcement talking about the Biden administration and what they're going to do from a trucking perspective. And the fact that diesel trucks, you know, are going to be a thing of the past. And they were talking about the cost of a diesel, you know, of a truck, you know, of a cab, you know, being, you know, 280,000 or 180,000 to 280,000. If they go 100% electric, you know, or another alternative fuel, could be 450,000. You know, so we have the best of intentions. We all want to save the planet, and at the same time, though, we're creating all kinds of issues just in the energy sector in general. So we're putting in place regulations that are harmful to what I'll call the old oil and gas industry. Everything wants to go electric. We're talking about alternative energy sources. Well, if every vehicle was electrified today, where would we possibly get all the electricity that's in the grid? I mean, at some point, I think sanity steps back in, and, you know, we're going to need oil and gas for a long time to come. And, you know, there probably is a move. I mean, if you go back to the turn of the 19th century or the 20th century, it's like, hey, there was a blacksmith on every corner, and people were still using buggies and carriages. We moved to automobiles. And it's like, I think we as a humanity will continue to evolve, and our energy sources will change over time. But we can't force this and make it happen overnight. So I think ultimately everyone recognizes that whether we want to say it in public or we want to say it in private, that, you know, the oil and gas industry still needs to exist. It's going to have to be there for several decades to come. And this move towards alternative energy sources is expensive, and it's going to be a slow moving, you know, moving buggy that's going to take a while for us to get there as a country for sure, and as a planet, as a world. So great to have all these high and mighty ideas, but the reality is we're still going to need oil and gas. We're going to need pipelines. We're going to need to drill. We're going to need projects. Projects need capital. And so I think funding sources that, you know, let's say if it's not mainstream, then we have to go to non-traditional sources. If there's money and profit to be made, private equity will find their way to the table. I think it's the long and short of it.
Yeah, I think reality is the operative word. There are the good intentions. I think the Biden administration is operating with good intentions, but there are a lot of unintended consequences with going down a path with the assumption that the future is going to be a certain way. And I'm waiting for somebody to do a post-mortem on all these divestments that these universities have done, because over the last 3 years, the energy sector has trounced every other sector by a long shot. I mean, technology is way, way back in second place behind what the energy sector's done for the past 3 years. So these endowments that have divested have cost themselves billions and billions of dollars. And especially if they traded out their oil and gas investments for renewables, because renewables have done very poorly over the past year. So, good intentions, but as long as you need the oil and gas, capital is going to flow in.
I work with a lot of family offices. So family offices are non-traditional in the sense that they act like a private equity firm, but they don't have limited partners. They're self-investing, their own fortunes. And so their hold periods aren't controlled in a way a traditional PE firm is. I'm seeing a lot more heavier investments from family offices into oil and gas infrastructure. So there's a vacuum. And the returns are there. There's massive returns to be made there. And so if, call it, the mainstream world starts pulling out of these investments because of these best intentions and unintended consequences, someone has to fill that void. And so I as I'm working with family offices, I'm here in Dallas, Texas, and king of oil country. And, as I'm talking to local family offices here, people are talking to me about the returns that they're seeing in energy, in oil and gas. And so I think there will, wherever there is a return to be made, there is someone who is willing to step in and fill that void. So I would say if you're in the oil and gas industry and financing is something that you need, I think what's happening is you're having a morphing in who is going to be providing the capital, but the capital will be there because the returns are there. There are still people who buy Philip Morris stock because there's a high dividend, and so oil and gas will find a way. It may be disrupted, but think about what's been happening in the broader economy, too. We had supply chain issues, for years. We had higher interest rates. We had inflation. As the broader economy, call it, has recovered, as interest rates start ticking down, people are looking for return. They're looking for alpha. They're looking for growth. And so if the traditional investment sources are pulling out because their limited partners are guiding them to, there is what I'll call alternative investors seeking that return, and they're stepping in to fill the void.
Adam, that was something I was going to ask you. We're going to take a quick break, but when we return, I want you to tell us about, in your books, you mentioned, or maybe it was on the podcast because I just follow you all over the place, where the amount of money that PE is getting back in the return compared to the stock exchange, these numbers are mind-boggling. I know you know what I'm talking about, but let's take a quick break, and when we return, we'll get that answer. You're listening to an Oil Patch Radio Show. We'll be right back. And we're back. You're listening to an Oil Patch Radio Show. Our guest today is Adam Coffey, best-selling author of a trilogy of books, and I'm not sure which book this one comes out of because I've read them all, but you have been discussing how much money private equity has been making compared to Wall Street, the returns. And that's kind of important when we look and see how much private equity is really doing and providing much needed money versus Wall Street. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So let's just take a stroll down memory lane. If I look back at my career as a CEO, so I started working with PE about 25 years ago. And at that time, if I roll tape back just 25 years, there was less than $1 trillion in assets under management, and there were probably around 1,400 private equity firms globally that were investing capital. Roll tape forward to today, there's over $6 trillion in assets under management, and there's more than 8,000 firms. And so money just keeps flooding into this asset class. And the reason isn't because they stink at making investments. On average, private equity is returning twice, the S&P 500. So a typical stock portfolio might return 8% on average over a 30-year period. In private equity, about 16%, 16 to 20%. So with the return being there, the money keeps flooding into the asset class that allows for more firms to be born, and be created and started. And, I would say it's certainly getting tougher to make those kinds of returns. The best PE firms are still doing that. But as money comes into the asset class, that money has to be put to work. And so people have to make investments with this capital. And, and therein lies the magic. And so, a standing joke kind of in the industry is Mitt Romney once upon a time said that there was a bubble in private equity, and this was in the 1980s. And the money just keeps flooding in for decades and decades and decades. And so, there is an ability to see an outsized return on investment, certainly beating the S&P 500, and so the money keeps pouring in. And, we've talked about a piece of that, and I think it's the larger private equity firms that certainly from an ESG perspective have tried to be focused on their investing around alternative energy type investments. There's a ton of smaller companies, though, that aren't focused, as much from an ESG perspective. They're looking for returns. And so wherever there's a project with a large return, money will find a way. There's currently today, just as we're talking here, well over $1 trillion in cash, in capital, out looking for deals to fund right now, right this second. And the one cardinal sin of private equity is not deploying your capital. So imagine you're a limited partner. You invest in private equity. Smallest investment size, about $5 million. So these are big investors, big investments that are being made. And you're going to tie up your money for a 10-year period in a fund that's illiquid. And so you have to hold this money in reserve. You're waiting for the capital to be called. You're not getting your 8%, in the stock market. And imagine the PE firm never calls your capital because they didn't put it to work. And now you didn't get your 16. You also didn't get the 8. Now you're really mad because you sat there and got nothing. And now this firm comes back to you and says, geez, we're raising our new fund. We'd love for you to be an investor. And I say, boy, you didn't put my last money to work. Why would I invest with you now in your new fund? So the money has to get put to work, and it's seeking returns, which means the capital is out there to fund projects. Who, which firms, how big, what size, those names may change over time, but the capital's out there.
Private equity and energy, I guess my question would be, so we're all familiar with the large PE firms, BlackRock, which has really been in the media a lot pertaining to their stance on energy, especially in Texas. They're in a little bit of some hot water. But are there any rules or metrics that apply to PE pertaining to ESG or anything that you're aware of that companies are very sensitive to what they want to invest in because of the ESG metrics? Where is PE going with that?
Yeah, so it depends on the firm. Like I said, because the capital is being sourced from university endowments and from public pension funds, which tend to be, have a certain political leaning and certain political beliefs, including a strong belief in ESG and alternative energy. In order to keep their capital coming into their firm and into their funds, they're having to adopt policies, that are in keeping with the beliefs of the majority of their investors. And so that's what fuels, I'll call it, the ESG movement. Privately, when I talk to people on Wall Street, it's like, I just want to make money. I need to put the money to work. I'm looking for a return. So some firms are more firmly grounded in their stance and belief in ESG than others. Some pay it lip service and then invest wherever they can get returns. Others are very serious about trying to be good stewards to their shareholders' money and their desires as limited partners are, I don't want to invest in those types of projects. And so, again, there's this kind of a little bit of a turmoil. Somebody just threw a big rock, in the pond, and it's like it's stirred up. But as the dust settles on all this, the capital's there. The capital will find a way. So, but it's being driven by primarily, this is what my investors are telling me. This is what they care about. Therefore, this has to be what I care about if I want to keep their money flowing into my funds. So it's being led by some large PE firms that have investors who want to be, and call it, environmentally conscious, and they want to invest in alternative energies. And so those firms are taking those public stances. There are other firms who are not.
Well, we're getting ready to go for another break, but when we return, I want to get back on your books and specifically maybe some strategies that you could give us pertaining to how energy companies would use and take advantage of PE firms for steady growth, if you will. I also just want to make us aware that what we're seeing in most of the operators, so we just finished CERAWeek, which is produced by S&P Global. Everybody, it's the red carpet of oil and gas, if you will. And this year was very much a different feel. It was all about energy transition. and all of the new stuff. So there was a lot of discussion on hydrogen and net zero, carbon capture, utilization, all these different things that need funding as well. But the interesting thing to me is that I'm seeing the traditional oil and gas large companies that have stockholders, they're moving into transitioning and including some alternative or cleaner fuels or cleaner ways of, you know, energy than just the traditional oil and gas. And that was kind of what was said in there, is if you're not moving to something else, you probably are going to have a lot of trouble when we talk about finances. So when we return from break, I want you to tell us specifically some of your books, some of the strategies that companies can use to continue with steady growth, is specifically in like the oil and gas sector. I think it's the Empire Builder part of the book, which I love that one too. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to In the Oil Patch Radio Show. We'll be right back.
Attention small and medium-sized business owners. Are you feeling overwhelmed with back office tasks like payroll, workers' compensation, federal regulations, safety laws, employment standards, and benefits? Don't worry, Unique HR has your back. For over 30 years, our team of qualified professionals has been providing people-centered solutions to help businesses like yours navigate the heavy burden of running a business and managing their workforce. We're the PEO with a pulse, and we are just a phone call away. Call us today at 361-852-6392. Unique HR, the partner you can trust.
And we're back. You're listening to In the Oil Patch Radio Show. Our guest today is Adam Coffey, best-selling author of a trilogy of books pertaining to private equity. Adam, before the break, thank you for telling us a little bit about how PE is operating in the oil and gas sector. It's definitely a lot more independent than how we're looking at funding stock market and their shareholders and how they're looking at they're going to fund energy projects. But specifically strategies from your book on how energy companies can achieve steady growth. What is some of the advice as an expert in this area? First, I think maybe you want to maybe back up and tell us a little bit about some of your past projects that have been so successful, and then maybe how energy companies that are struggling can look towards PE as well.
Well, in any market, whether the market's up or down, there's always opportunities. You know, there's opportunities to take advantage of, you know, different types of economic conditions to maximize your potential. So let's talk about that for a second. You know, in the last empire that I built, I bought 23 small companies and I put them together and I became a much larger company. And I was rewarded with, you know, a nice uplift. It's called arbitrage. So I buy 23 companies and these are small companies that are trading, relatively speaking, these are small companies that trade for 5 times a multiple of EBITDA. I put the 23 together and then I sell it for 14 times EBITDA. You know, there's 33 million small companies in the United States. There's only 1,000 companies on the planet that have $1 billion in revenue. You know, and 3,000, 2,000 are public, 1,000 are private. So 33 million small companies, not enough buyers possibly to drive those prices up. And so I can pay relatively small prices because there's a plentiful amount of them. As I get bigger, I become rarer very quick. And then those private equity firms that we talk about, some of those giant ones, they can't possibly buy small companies with their giant funds. It would take them 100 years to put all their capital to work. So they pay higher multiples for larger companies that allow them to put more capital to work. There's fewer of them in the marketplace. When they come to market, those are special assets that people have to jump onto in order to deploy their capital. And so, you know, this thing called arbitrage, it works both in, call it, outside the oil and gas world. It also works inside the oil and gas world. And so when there are a multitude of companies in a fragmented industry, then there is an opportunity. And if, you know, if prices are down, then I can buy these companies relatively cheaply. I can combine them together and I can climb the PE pyramid, become rare and become worth a much higher multiple I'm rewarded with. And make money, you know, off of the arbitrage, which is the difference between the small company, what it sells for, and what a big company sells for. But when I think about oil and gas, I think about strategic. I call it pivots. You know, in my book, you know, in Empire Builder, I talk about making strategic pivots. If you are in a market that is, you know, they call it red ocean. So it's red from the blood of competition. You know, it's commoditized. You're having a hard time making money. You think about all of these trillions of dollars that are earmarked for all these ESG type projects, alternatives and renewables. Well, I could be in the oil and gas industry and I could be making some strategic pivots to open up new markets, which might include making investments. If I'm an expert in oil and gas, There's no reason why I can't also be an expert in some method or form of an alternative energy source or a renewable or some type of other industry that is adjacent and complementary to what I do. You might say it's polar opposites, but energy's energy. Whether it's traditional or it's, you know, an alternative source, if I'm in the energy world and I'm an expert, there is potential for me to think about making a strategic acquisition, to create a new division, you know, to take advantage of some of the funding, you know, the government funding that's out there that's available. And so I can be building, you know, alternative revenue streams while I'm riding out and protecting, you know, call it the revenue streams that are more traditional, waiting for that part of the market to bounce back. And I think Robert said, I think we were off, you know, on break when he mentioned it, just, you know, which sector did the best in Q1 of this year in the stock market? You know, it was the energy sector, you know, and so, you know, it's like, this is not a dead industry. This is an industry that very much, you know, is needed and it's in demand. It may be out of favor for a brief period of time, but don't confuse that with necessary, needed. And keep in mind that we can also do, you know, as I said, make these strategic pivots to create additional opportunities. If I'm a small company in the oil and gas space, I could look at other small companies in the oil and gas space, potentially, you know, think about mergers, acquisitions, to where I could take my small company, build a bigger presence, you know, call it right now while maybe I'm out of favor. And then as I come back into favor, you know, ride a bigger company into a higher place. A lot of different potential opportunities out there for us to make money and to take advantage of, you know, disruption.
And that's why they need to read the book, Empire Builder. Let's take a quick break. You're listening to an Oil Patch Radio Show. We'll be right back.
Hey, when you're in business, you have to make a lot of tough choices. So let's talk about an easy one, your workers' comp coverage. If you're a propane or butane dealer or operator, you need to join the Lone Star Energy Safety Group through Texas Mutual Insurance Company. As a member, you'll automatically get a discount on your premium. Plus, you can earn double dividends that'll go straight into your pocket. It's the easiest decision you'll ever make. Find out more at texasmutual.com/Lone Star Energy.
And we're back. You're listening to In the Oil Patch Radio Show. Our guest today is Adam Coffey, who is a best-selling author of a trilogy of books that you really need to get pertaining to some of the great work that he has written about when we talk about private equity. Robert, I think you have a question for Adam.
Adam, I'm a lifetime stock market guy. I started investing in stock market in high school, and I've done that for the last 40 years. That's the world that I know. Why would I want to invest in small-scale private equity? You know, what sort of are the entry requirements? What kind of money are we talking about? And what sort of risks would I need to be aware of? So basically, why would I leave the stock market for small private equity?
Good question. So the reason you potentially might seek to get exposure to this asset class is because the typical return profile is around double the S&P 500. So, you know, if I'm buying a stock market index fund, you know, and over a 30-year period, I'm getting 8%, call it, I would expect to get about 16% if I was investing in this particular asset class. So what's required? How do I get exposure to it? Well, first of all, if I want to be a direct investor in a private equity firm's fund, typical minimum investment size is $5 million. So you have to be a large-scale investor. Keep in mind that a private equity fund is generally illiquid for 10 years. For the first 5 years, they're going to be calling capital. I'm going to be committing capital, you know, typical minimum, $5 million. I'll be writing checks for the first 4 or 5 years as they're making investments over that 10-year life. And then for the last 5 years, I'll be getting money wired back to me. And so I think of it as a 10-year tide. The tide rolls out for the first five as I'm writing my checks, and then it rolls back in and gives me all the return over the next 5 years. So for most people, you know, we probably can't play directly as an investor, you know, as a limited partner in a PE fund. It's $5 million. I have to be an accredited investor. You know, there's a lot around that, you know, because of the length of the investment and the fact that there's, you know, illiquidity. There's no liquidity there. It eliminates a lot of call it the smaller investors. But I can get exposure to the asset class. You know, I'll give you an example. Some of these large PE firms are publicly traded. You know, mm-hmm. And so if you think about how PE firms make their money, they charge a 2% management fee for all the capital that they manage annually. And then they charge a 20% carried interest fee, which essentially is 20 cents of every dollar of profit that they're about to return to their investors, they keep. And, you know, when you're a publicly traded private equity firm, that 2 and 20 is available. I could be buying stock, you know, in on a publicly traded PE firm, you know, and make those investments. And I'm kind of investing in the firm. You know, think of it like Bank of America or Wells Fargo. It's like when I put money in the bank, that money is private. The bank is public, but it's still my money. I'm putting it in, I'm taking it out. So they're managing my money, they're making money on my money, and that's what I'm investing in. And so that's one way a common investor can invest and get some exposure to private equity is by investing in some of these public companies that are actually managing private equity funds. You know, and we've mentioned some of those names here today. So that's one way to get the exposure. But the reason I'd want the exposure to the asset class is because generally over the last 30 years, it's outperformed the S&P 500.
Well, so then that answers my question. As a stock market guy, that's how I can get exposure through the stock market.
Correct.
I have a question. Explain to me again, Robert and I, how you sell companies 5 times or potentially 5 times. Explain that whole formula. It's brilliant.
Yeah. So, you know, a PE fund lasts for 10 years. You know, when they raise capital and they create a fund, it's illiquid. And so it has to have a finite start and stop. And so they exist for a 10-year period within their own charter. You know, they essentially say for the first 5 years, I can call capital from my investors and I can go out and buy companies. And then within that 10-year period, I have to return the capital back to my investors. On average, that means I've got about 5 years to work with a company. And so depending, you know, here's some interesting statistics. So there's 8,000 PE firms out there. The largest ones have fund sizes that range from $10 billion to $30 billion in size, whereas a small PE firm might be managing out of an $80 million, $100 million, or $300 million fund. But they all do the same exact thing. They all invest 6 to 8% of their capital in any one, you know, company when they buy a company. And by charter, they can't invest more than 12%. They have their own little asset diversification rules that they build into their fund structure. And so whether I'm a huge fund or a small fund, all of us want to invest 6 to 8% of our money into one company, which means big firms have to buy big companies, little firms have to buy little companies. And as a result of this, what there are is I call them swim lanes. There's 5 swim lanes of capital in the world of private equity that's out there going back and forth looking for stuff to buy. And if I'm at the bottom, I'm going from 0 to $15 million in EBITDA. And that's about how far I can get in 5 years. And then the guys who sell at 15, they sell it to someone who goes from 15 to 50. And that's how far they can get in 5 years. And then it's 50 to 100 and 100 to 200 and 200. You probably are going public after that because you're running out of private capital and you've already had loan syndications with public banks and you're already going to the rating agencies. And so as you're climbing this pyramid of capital, eventually you get so big and it's so hard to stay private that you wind up having to go public. And so these 5 natural swim lanes allow an entrepreneur who's growing a company to sell it multiple times. And so think of it, you know, I think of it this way. I'm a tool for private equity. Private equity has capital. They don't come with leadership teams. You know, they come with capital. They buy companies. You know, I'm a tool. I'm a tool to help them grow a business, and then they have to sell it in order to monetize it. I don't go anywhere. I'm still here. And so one shareholder is going out. Another set of shareholders is coming in because I've gone, you know, to the top of that swim lane. I'm at the bottom of the next swim lane, and there's a new class of buyers who are investing 6 to 8% of their funds, which are bigger than the ones down below. And now they come in, swoop me up, and they take me for the next 5 years. And so as a result of that, I literally, I mean, you know, the one company that I ran for 13 years and 4 months, I sold 5 times, you know, and it's, I'm selling it at different sizes to different private equity firms who are using me as an investment vehicle to generate returns for their shareholders.
I'm trying to grow a business, and I and my employees, you know, the thousands of employees, we're the continuity, we're the business. And private equity is just capital that's coming in, leaving, different time periods, new capital coming in, going out. And so, you know, we're tools for each other. And private equity is, currently today, private equity buys around 50% of all companies that are sold on the planet. You literally can't go through an entire day without encountering a logo, you know, of a company that's owned by private equity. So you can't even go camping in Denali National Park because half your camping gear is going to be backed by a private equity fund, you know, that owns this company. So it's like private equity has quietly permeated every industry on the planet. They're buying 50% of the companies, and they're also the world's largest source of non-bank debt. So if I'm in the market for money and for whatever reason I can't get enough from a commercial bank, you know, commercial bank might allow me to lever up 2-3 times my earnings, and I have a gap, I want to do something, I need more capital, I go to a mezzanine lender, and that mezzanine lender is a class of private equity. It's a private equity debt fund. And so the world's largest source of capital comes from private equity.
Let's take a quick break. When we return, I want to continue on mergers and acquisitions, this exact topic. You're listening to an Oil Patch Radio Show. We'll be right back. And we're back. You're listening to In the Oil Patch Radio Show. Our guest today is Adam Coffey. Adam, before the break, you were telling us about how companies, when an entrepreneur maybe owns a $10 million, $15 million a year service company, wants to really explode. So they turn to PE. They turn to somebody like you that already has the experience in this industry of knowing how to do it, and you accept that company. They basically will be bought out to a degree, or they'll lose the majority of their shares. And you mentioned that this is not the ending of you get your money and you go and you retire. This continues on if they're smart. Talk to me about that formula.
Most entrepreneurs see selling their company as the end of the road. You know, this is my destination. This is where I get off. And I tell people, selling your company doesn't have to be the end. It's what I call the first rest stop on the wealth creation highway. And so I'm trying to get entrepreneurs to change their thinking. You know, they think about, I'm going to get a wheelbarrow full of gold, and I'm going to exit stage left. And now what? You know, and now I got to figure out what to do with my wheelbarrow full of gold. I've left the company I just built. You know, I've beat the odds. I'm successful. Now I got to go find something new to do. I tell entrepreneurs, don't leave, stay. You know, go from being the sole shareholder or the control shareholder to being the minority shareholder. And, you know, a lot of bravado. Oh, if I'm not the guy, if I don't have 100%, I don't want to be subservient to anybody. And I always answer that with Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk. The two of them, Robert, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the two of them own less than 13% of their companies, and they're the two wealthiest guys on the planet. And if they can be minority shareholders, so can you. So what does that look like? Well, you know, I'm growing my business, and I need capital to grow my business. And when I'm a small business owner, I've beat the odds. I'm one of only 7% of companies on the planet that got to $1 million in revenue. I'm one of only 4% of those that got to $10 million in revenue. Long about $20 or $30 million in revenue, I start to kind of top out. I don't have any more bandwidth. It's like I need to find a new gear. I'm the new gear, you know? And so you sell your business, you roll over a portion of the proceeds, let's call it 30%. And, you know, the typical private equity fund is looking for a 3X to a 4X multiple of invested capital. So if I have rolled over, let's say I sell my company for a dollar, I take 70 cents home, I pay some taxes, and I diversify my asset base. You know, I create, you know, investor, you know, I diversify my personal wealth. I roll the 30 cents forward. If I get that 3 to 4X kind of private equity style return at 4X, my 30 cents times 4 equals $1.20. My second check can actually be bigger than the first check. And so I do it again, and I take 70 cents on a dollar home. I diversify my asset base. I roll another 30 cents forward. Another PE firm comes in, and I continue the ride. And what I'm doing now is I'm building my business using other people's money. I am an investor. I'm no longer the control investor. And I no longer have to worry about where capital comes from. That's their responsibility. And I go out and I start accelerating growth. I'm investing in organic growth. I'm making strategic pivots. I'm acquiring companies using their capital, their debt relationships. And my growth trajectory starts to accelerate. And before you know it, I've gone from $30 million I'm now crashing through 100 million. I'm on my way to 200, 500, to a billion. And that's what I've been doing for my entire career is, you know, I come in with a company. Maybe the platform company has 200 million in revenue. I was doing this on a big stage, big scale. And then I buy 23 companies that all have 20 to 30 million in revenue apiece, and I put them all together and I create operating leverage because I don't need 23 accounting departments. I don't need 23 HR departments. You know, and so my revenue is growing faster than my expenses. I'm creating operating leverage. My margins are improving. I'm using someone else's money. I've built an M&A machine. I'm buying companies. I'm growing organically. I'm improving my margins. I'm doing all of these things which create an increase in earnings, which creates an increase in shareholder value because I sell this bigger company for a larger multiple than the multiple I started with. It's like the growth is phenomenal. And so my personal record selling the same company 5 times in a 13-year, 4-month period, you know, and it's like, so again, why sell once when you can sell twice? And so if I'm a small company out there listening to this radio show right now, you know, I can think about, you know, could I potentially accelerate my growth by merging with or buying out some of the people I know in the space, maybe making a strategic pivot, creating some new revenue streams that are adjacent to my existing revenue streams? And, you know, it's like there's all of these activities that private equity really exploits on a grand level. And I've been teaching smaller companies how to do this through my books, through seminars and coaching, you know, to show the little people how we can do this on a small scale and get the same results that the big PE firms are getting when they do it with a guy like me as a CEO on a grand stage. And so a lot of potential out there. Never sell your company and think it's the end of the road unless you're just ready to go off to retirement land and go fishing every day.
Adam, you mentioned in your book the laundromat or the washing machine, a couple of other companies. Can you give us a quick example of how you took one company and just supercharged it?
Yeah, so that particular company, when I got to it, I was hired by the founding family. The company was founded in 1947. They hired me in 2003. So the company was, you know, roughly 50 years old, you know, when I got there. And it had grown into quite an empire. And I helped that family make the company more efficient, investing in technology, improving process, Six Sigma, Lean Sigma, doing all the stuff that GE taught me how to do. You know, so I spent the first 5 years doubling the company's earnings without really changing much about the company itself. I did some partial sales of assets, gave the family a ton of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I was like, oh, that was fun. You know, well, why don't we keep on doing that? Let's sell the whole thing. So sold the final big piece of it to a private equity firm, transitioned from family owned and operated to PE owned. Then over the next, you know, 10 plus years, you know, or so, I bought 34 companies and combined them. And so I went from small family, well, not small, but family owned and operated, you know, selling it off in pieces, taking one of the big pieces and then going to private equity and then buying 34 more companies and then growing all across North America, including invading Canada. And I by the time I was done, I had a 90% market share in Canada, you know, and in 2 years prior to going to Canada, I had zero, you know, and I went from zero to 90% of that particular market, you know, by buying 4 companies in Canada. You know, there were 5 major players. I bought 4 of them. And so, you know, the growth was just phenomenal. But in addition to that, we had a really cool culture. People loved working there. And they would bring their friends and their relatives and their kids and, you know, multi-generational family. All the businesses that I built were very strong in cultures, you know, and, you know, hey, in a service business, you can't store service in a box and put it on a shelf, you know, so therefore your product is people. So I always started by building very strong cultures. And when I build a strong culture, I get an engaged workforce. They take care of customers. Customers give us more stuff. Revenue just kind of rains from the skies. And so a beautiful period of growth, you know, that culminated in a $1 billion+ sale, you know, for the last time that I was there and sold the business. And so went from family owned and operated to $1 billion business, you know, in a 13-year period. Multiple ownership periods with family owned, private equity.
We will be adding a link for your Amazon books. And I'm going to highly encourage, if you're interested in PE, if you're not getting the funding that you need, look to Adam. And thank you for coming and being a guest on the show today. Really appreciate it. Your books have a lot of great information pertaining to private equity and a solution to companies growing if they're not quite ready to go and sign an IPO. Adam, thank you for being a guest on In the Oil Patch Radio Show.
Thank you, and thank you to all your listeners.
In the Oil Patch is where, together, we explore topics that affect us all in oil, gas, business, and in your community. Every week, your host, Kim Bellotto, will visit with the movers and shakers in this fast-paced industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, and many more right here on In the Oil Patch.